Wow, that was quite a journey down memories lane. We sometimes wonder as pastors what is heard or remembered of what we speak, and I am impressed. It reminds me of a story of three friends who loved to hunt together. One was a doctor, one was a lawyer, and the other was a minister. Quite a combination, and they were all three out in the bush one day hunting, and the lawyer, of course, was carrying his gun like this, and the doctor was very safety conscious, and he had his gun pointing down to the ground, and the pastor had his tucked underneath his arm like that he would carry his Bible, and all of a sudden, they saw a deer, and all three of them shot at the deer, and they killed the deer. However, then the fun began because each of the three of them claimed they were the one that had shot the deer. The lawyer claimed, no, he did. So did the doctor. So did the minister. And the game warden happened to come along at that point. So they thought they'd let him settle their dispute. And they told them their predicament. And the game warden walked up to the deer and walked around it twice and said, oh, he said, this is easy. It was the minister, and the doctor and the lawyer both immediately responded and said, well, come on now, how can you be sure that so quickly that it was the minister's shot that killed this deer? And the game warden said, oh, that was easy. Just look at the path and direction of the bullet. It went in one ear and out the other. I must say that I have not sensed that among you this weekend. I think some things are sticking and not just passing through. And I'm thankful to God for that. And we have, and I appreciate being here with you. It was a good weekend. And God bless you as you seek His will, His way in every situation of life. The choices and the decisions that you make from day to day. And may we be content. We're going to carry on tonight and conclude this weekend together by looking further at financial bondage, then move on to financial freedom, and then move on and talk about the end of life or things how we should plan for when we leave this life. We had considered last evening financial bondage, and we looked at a number of situations which were financial bondage, and the definition I gave you for financial bondage, if you remember, was that financial bondage is anything material that destroys your relationship either vertically or horizontally with God or with man is financial bondage. And we looked at a number of things here, if you recall, credit cards, we talked about that, financial bondage when we borrow for highly depreciable items for investment purposes, and also the interest costs of borrowing. Now let's consider what causes financial bondage. How do we get into the situation that we're in bondage? Well, one of the main factors that I believe causes financial bondage is ignorance and a lack of understanding. We just don't know. And that's why a weekend like this is so exciting to me, to be together, to look at God's Word and His principles for us in making decisions so that we are not ignorant and that we do not lack understanding. Proverbs 24:3 tells us, through wisdom is a house builded, and by understanding is it established. And by knowledge shall the chambers be filled with all precious and pleasant riches. So let's look to God for wisdom, the source of wisdom in the decisions we need to make. Let's seek counsel from each other. Secondly is wrong attitudes. When we have the wrong attitude and the wrong motives when it comes to material possessions, then where there's envying, where there's strife, James 3:16 tells us, there is confusion and every evil work. When we're desiring, when we're wanting, when we're envying, wanting more and more, versus being content with what we have, that leads us to bondage. And remember, contentment is something that each of us need to work on in our lives. We talked about posting tax returns, and they would not be the same, and contentment would be an issue. Contentment is an issue for us in many, many different areas, and we sometimes feel that we perhaps got the raw end of the deal, the wrong end of the stick, or whatever, in our situation and what we face, versus the other person and how their life is going. Reminds me of a situation in a town where the people were constantly complaining and grumbling, and there was no contentment. They all had problems, and they all thought their problems and their complaints were worse than the other person's. And the mayor of the town very wisely, now this is impossible, let's assume for a moment it is, he said, all right, tomorrow I want all of you to take your problems, and I want you to put your problems and your burdens in a burlap bag, and we're going to hang them on a wash line. We're going to hang them on a line in the town center. So they did, as I said, if that were possible. They did put all their problems and all their burdens into a bag, hung it on the wash line. And the mayor said, now, yes, you've gotten rid of your problems and your burden, but now you have to go back home and you have to take one bag with you. And guess what? Everyone took their own bag back home. So let's deal and let's work on contentment. Also, another reason for financial bondage is poor planning. And Jesus talked about that situation when he talked about people that were intending to build a tower and they didn't sit down first and count the cost and whether they had sufficient to finish it. Lest happily after they'd laid the foundation and not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Talking about memory lane, for some of you that are older, when the expressway was fairly new, when you used to drive in the north end of Waterloo, do you remember that building that was there that just had a foundation for the longest time? It always reminded me of this scripture of somebody who planned to build that building but didn't consider how they were going to finish it. So we need to plan. We also need to be aware that financial bondage comes when we do not communicate, when we do not seek advice. We need each other's assistance in life. None of us travel this road alone. And even though we think what we are facing, we might be the only ones, everyone also has a bag of their own issues that they are dealing with. So let's communicate when we come into situations, when it pertains to finances, just like we would with any other situation, and especially communication between husband and wife in money matters. Now I'd like to move on and look at the signs, the symptoms of financial bondage. And you can use this as a checklist to determine whether you are in financial bondage. And the first one that I see as indicating to me that someone is in financial bondage, if there are overdue bills. Psalm 37:21 tells us, the wicked borroweth, payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. If you have the pressure of bill collectors at your door, if you need call display on your telephone that you answer only certain phone calls because if you're afraid of who is calling, wondering where their payment is, or if you have stacks of unopened mail that includes bills that need to be paid, to me that's a sign of financial bondage. That's not how you want to live. Secondly, financial bondage comes when we fall prey to get-rich-quick schemes. Proverbs 28:2 tells us, he that hasteneth to be rich hath an evil eye and considereth not that poverty shall come upon him. This hastening to be rich, this quick-rich schemes that are out there. For example, one of the big ones is lottery tickets. And I just have to shake my head when I think of the lottery tickets and how it works. Lottery tickets are a tax on the poor for those who can least afford it. And when the value of that jackpot gets up into the millions of dollars, you go into a mall and you see the lineups to buy a lottery ticket. And the chances of being struck by lightning are much better than winning a lottery. And the sad part is, research has been done that most lottery winners who win millions of dollars, 5 years after they had won, they are much poorer than they were prior to winning the lottery. How sad is that? Trying to gain riches at the certain loss of another violates every principle that was taught by Jesus Christ. Well, then let's get a little more personal. Then I think there's agreement that lotteries are not for us as Christians. Memory lane, Gary, you and I go back a long way too. I think 30 years ago, I would pick on you at a Bible study at times, and I just might do that again tonight. Do you agree with me, first of all, what I just said about lottery tickets? You do. Good. All right. So now you're enjoying a rare evening at home, and all of a sudden, there's a knock on your door. You answer the door, and someone is there, and they are collecting money for the Cancer Society with a raffle ticket for a house worth $850,000 if you win this raffle in buying this ticket to support Cancer Society or put your favorite charity, whatever you want in. How are you going to respond to me at your door? It happens. Are you going to buy a ticket for the chance for the $850,000 house? Not a trick question. You haven't thought about it, but I'm at your door. I'm expecting an answer. Sorry? You would say probably not. And you're not concerned about your testimony in saying probably not. That's okay. If it was a cause that I truly believed in, I agree with where you're coming from, Gary. If it's a cause that I truly believed in and I wanted to support, I would give the money for the ticket as a donation and say I don't want the ticket or tear up the ticket to me. Okay? To me, it just borders too closely on that of lottery. Well, then let's get a little closer to home. What about open house being held somewhere and the door prizes that are there and your ticket is called that you won the door prize? You see that in a different light? I no longer just pick on Gary here. I'll now pick on Gerald a little bit here. Do you see that in a different light, Gerald? Should you be accepting that door prize if you win it? Or is that wrong? Okay. I don't necessarily think that is wrong. There is no chance, there's chance involved whether you win, but that is a part of that business's advertising costs that they're making those products or their suppliers are making those products available to give as gifts, so to speak, as a door prize. So I put that one in a different light myself, personally. But that's up to you. If you want to also decline door prizes, I'm quite all right with that. But let's remember that these quick get-rich schemes are not for us as Christians. And I'm going to tread on a little bit of choppy waters here and talk a little bit about farmers and cash crop farmers and futures markets, where we commit to sell something at a price when we haven't even put the seed in the ground at a future date at a set price. Is that okay to plan on the future that way when we haven't put the seed in the ground and say we're going to sell our corn this fall when it's spring for so much a bushel? Well, I'm going to read to you James 4:13-15. Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanishes away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. So I ask you to consider in the aspect, and this is affecting poor farmers, not that farmers are poor, excuse me, but the situation makes it very difficult for a farmer, that one bushel of corn or a commodity is sold many times over on the Chicago Board of Exchange, and the actual product doesn't even exist. It's a paper buying and selling, which then determines the price for the farmer. And this, to me, is borders very, very strongly on speculation, if it is speculation. It reminds me of, this is a true account of a farmer who also had a furniture shop on his farm, and the man drove in a customer and to buy some furniture, and he saw what my farmer friend had in his field, and he asked, "Now, what crop is that?" And he said, "Oh, that's beans." "Oh," he said, "that's what a bean looks like." He said, "I buy and sell beans all the time, and I had no idea what they look like." And when we, that's what's happening on the Board of Exchange. So when we commit to selling something that we have not grown, can it cause sleepless nights for us? Then we also will probably need crop insurance to ensure that we have a crop to sell at the price we committed. And a good farmer friend of mine has researched over the years, and he believes that a farmer over time will be just as far ahead by selling his crop at current prices when he harvests it versus using the futures market. I'll leave that with you. It's very clear that speculating is wrong. And for me, with my little 5-acre plot that we live on, not being a farmer, there's no way that I should be buying and selling corn that I never take possession of to try and buy it on futures to sell at a certain price. For me, not being a farmer, never taking possession of that product is not right. Question is also asked, so is it wrong for a farmer to fix the price of his product that he will grow when he has to borrow from the bank to finance the growth of that product? And that is a very good question. And there's no easy answers to all of this, but I think we need to keep in perspective our dependence on God. And all I ask in all of this discussion is, are you sleeping well at night, or are you second-guessing your decisions? Is your mood, is your disposition affected by the price of commodities? And do you bemoan the fact that you sold or bought at the wrong time? That, to me, is bordering on financial bondage. Thirdly, our investment worries. If we're worrying about our investments, and I gave some guidelines this morning of how we should be investing, if they're causing us worry, anxiety, sleepless night, and if the performance of the stock market, like someone mentioned, is the first thing we look at every day, then we're in financial bondage. If we're making our investments as a result of greed or pride or envy, we're investing for the wrong reasons. Remember, always remember, if it sounds too good to be true, be sure it is. A number of years ago, a member of our congregation came to me all excited about an investment opportunity that was being presented to him. It had a tremendous return offered to him by a total stranger. And this was such a good deal. And I looked at him, and I, thankfully, he asked me whether he took my advice or not. I have no idea. But I said to him, if this is such a great deal, and if this is so good, why would a total stranger be offering it to you, and why would he not be hoarding it for his own family? And there are all kinds of historic and current situations we could look at. We could look at Bernie Madoff in the United States, who ripped off investors for millions and millions of dollars. And very current in our minds yet in the recent past is the Pigeon King scheme, where there was no end market for the product, and people would come to me and I would say, this is going to crash, this is not going to sustain itself, it's not going to work, and it kept going, and it kept going, and on, but finally, the house of cards fell. Why is it that we as Mennonites fall for these things so readily? Sales pressure is there, referral from a friend. I used to think, and I used to reason, that we as Mennonites are falling for these things because we're gullible. But I've changed my mind. I have come to the conclusion that it's not because we're gullible, but because of another G word, and that word is greed. It's greed that is making us take these chances doing these things. So before making any investment decisions, seek counsel from your spouse, someone from the church. Allow a cooling off period after you make a decision before you make the investment. And most importantly, pray, seek God's direction, and have peace with the decisions that you are going to make. Fourthly is something that I hope is not part of our situation, but it also is financial bondage, is when we're voluntarily unemployed. And this is so prevalent in our society. To collect unemployment insurance, and people saying, I'm better off doing that than working. And what do the scriptures say about this? The scriptures say in 2 Thessalonians 3:10, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. Further, Ephesians 4:28, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. That's our responsibility as Christians, is to put in an honest day's work. Also, deceitful practices. We need to be very careful to keep our testimony clean and pure in our business dealings. We need to be faithful in what is entrusted to us. If we're not faithful in this unrighteous mammon, who's going to commit to us these true riches? What do you do? I know what I have determined to do. When you get someone in to do a service for you, whether it's duck cleaning or eave trough cleaning, I don't care what it is, and they come along and they tell you that it's X number of dollars if you pay in cash, but if you're going to give me a check, it's this amount of money. And you know very well why it's $10 if you pay cash and why it's $13 if you are giving a check. This individual is trying and attempting to avoid paying the HST and income tax on that money. And if it's cash, it's the underground economy. And the underground economy is huge. We should not have any part of that. Even though that item costs us $3 more, or whatever the figure is when it's cash, versus being honest in our business practice. Also, when we sell things to someone, are we upfront with the product that we're selling? I hope we are. I hope we're not like a farmer I read about, and he sold a horse, and at the time of selling the horse, he said the horse doesn't look so good. And a week later, the buyer returned, and he was somewhat upset, and he said to the farmer, he said, you sold me a blind horse. This horse cannot see. And he said, no, I didn't. I told you the horse does not look so good. To me, that is deceitful business practices. Also, growing greed. Financial bondage comes when we always think we need more and we're always trying to get more, being covetousness is condemned in the scriptures. Ephesians 5:5 tells us that a list of people who will not inherit the kingdom of God, and it includes a covetous man. Further, we're in financial bondage if we ignore and neglect the needs around us. If a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be ye warmed and filled, notwithstanding ye give them not those things which are needful to the body, what doth it profit? We have, dear friends, a God-given responsibility to meet the needs of those in the household of faith. A recent survey of Christians asked the question, if poverty were to strike your home, and I don't know what degree these were as Christians, but if poverty were to strike your home, who would you most trust to meet your needs? The state, or the province, I should say, or the church? Who would you trust to most be who would be meeting your needs? And 95% said they would trust the state. They would trust the government before they trust their church. That is a sad commentary on how we should be living our lives. It reminds me of a story I read at one church on a Sunday morning where the church announced that they were going to have an offering for a poor family in their community that next Sunday. And there was a widowed mother who had four children as part of that church congregation. And they went home from church, and they were excited about being able to help this poor family. So for that week, because that offering was going to be the next Sunday, they cut back on their groceries, and they emptied the little savings that they had in their piggy bank, and were very thankful the next Sunday that they were able to put $30 on the offering plate for this poor family. And that afternoon, they were surprised to hear a knock at their door, and it was the deacon of the church. And he handed them an envelope to the mother and said that this offering was for them. And in amazement, she opened the envelope and she found $75 in it. How sad. Financial bondage. Vocational overcommitment. This is something we need to work at. How do we balance work, family, and church? I'll give you a guideline. I don't believe that our work and our job should consume more than 60 hours of our time per week, or the family and the church is going to suffer, and I believe we'll lose out spiritually. If we can't make a living by working 60 hours a week, let me assure you, you're not going to make it by working 70 or 80 hours a week either. Maybe that's a strong statement, but that's what I believe. Avoid money entanglements. And by that I mean business partnerships, agreements, deals with non-Christians. 2 Timothy 2:4, no man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. Business partnerships with somebody whose beliefs and values are different than ours. There are many horror stories who have lived to regret, who have not followed the biblical command of not being unequally yoked with unbelievers. Be very, very careful who you enter business partnerships with. Sleepless nights. If you're worrying and can't sleep at night, this is an additional sign of financial bondage. For the sleep of a laboring man, Ecclesiastes tells us, is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. So I've shared with you here a number of signs that I believe show financial bondage, being in a situation that we should not be in. And I have the good news tonight that we do not need to live in financial bondage, but that we can experience financial freedom. And once we've tasted financial freedom, it's very similar to spiritual freedom, and we never again want to return to the bondage of the past. And financial freedom, I share this evening, is possible, and it's the plane on which we are to live our lives. And as we transition here now from a discussion of financial bondage to financial freedom, I want to share with you a poem that was written by Edgar Guest. Out of this life I shall never take, things of silver and gold I make, all that I cherish and hoard away, after I leave on earth must stay. Though I have toiled for a painting rare to hang on my wall, I must leave it there. Though I call it mine and boast of its worth, I must give it up when I quit the earth. All that I gather and all that I keep, I must leave behind when I fall asleep. And I often wonder what I shall own in that other life when I pass alone. What shall they find and what shall they see in the soul that answers the call for me? Shall the great judge learn when my task is through that the spirit had gathered some riches too? Or shall it at the last be mine to find that all I had worked for I'd left behind? I trust not. Let's not labor in vain and leave it up all behind. But let's experience financial freedom in our lives. Let's lay not up ourselves treasures on earth, which will be left behind. But let's seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And then all these other things are going to be added unto us. Financial freedom comes when we realize and practice in every aspect of life, as I said, that God has given us everything that we have. It is his. Do we daily recognize this? Everything we love, hold dear. It's a gift from God, and God must come first. Billy Graham said, if a person gets his attitude toward money straightened out, then almost all other areas of life will be straightened out. Speaking again to the fact of how closely financial and spiritual things are related together. Remember, we're the stewards. We're managing the affairs, the assets of another. Financial freedom includes that we have a good reputation in all areas of stewardship. That is, we'll have a good name. We'll be known for our honest dealings. A good name is rather to be chosen than riches. A good name and a good reputation includes keeping our word. It means when we borrow items from our neighbor that we return them in as good a shape or better shape than when we borrowed them. That's a good name. And Exodus 24:14, the Old Testament speaks to that, that if a man borrow aught of his neighbor and it be hurt or die, speaking about an animal, I guess, the owner thereof being not with it, he shall surely make it good. So in other words, if we borrow something from someone and we are not able to return it in the same state we borrowed it in, or better, then we need to make it good. And we have an example of this in the Old Testament in 2 Kings. You remember Elisha, he was a prophet, and he had a school for prophets, and they were building a building in which to live, and they were cutting down trees. And when they were cutting down trees, all of a sudden one of the axes was lost in the river, and the student prophet, he cried out in 2 Kings, "Alas, master, for it was borrowed." So there was a tremendous responsibility on an individual who borrowed something and that it was returned. Financial freedom also means that we're going to use honest business dealings. We're going to be just in our weights and our business's dealings. Dishonesty will cost you. Your sins will find you out. When our daughter Faith was in grade one, she recited for a speech a story that speaks of using just weights and measures in our business dealings, where it was 5 to 5 on a Saturday night and the butcher shop was about ready to be closed up for the night. And a fussy old lady came in who did every week and said she wanted to buy a chicken. And the owner of the meat market thought, oh good, he had one chicken left and it was in the display area yet. And she asked, and how much does that chicken weigh? And he put it on the scale and he said it weighs 5 pounds. And she said, oh, she said, that's too little. She said, I need a bigger one. So he took that chicken to the back room. He came out with the same chicken, put it on the count on the scale, put his thumb behind the scale and said, this one weighs 7 pounds, ma'am. And she thought for a moment and she says, oh, she says, I changed my mind. I think I'll take them both. Just weights and measures in our business practices. We briefly discussed earlier financial freedom involving making prompt payments, following through with commitments. And remember, a reminder again, I cannot stress this enough, that if we're not able to meet a commitment, that we're in touch with the individuals involved immediately, rather than waiting or expecting or not expecting, whatever the case might be, for that individual to contact us. We will be careful to keep right associates. We will be careful who we seek our counsel from. You can get all kinds of counsel, anything you want to hear, depending what person you go to. And we want to place ourselves under the accountability of others. We're going to make sure that our motives remain right and pure. That's financial freedom. That means we're not going to push down or run ahead of others. Our primary focus in this life should be that, and the same as it was for the Apostle Paul, where he said, "Those things which were gain for me, those I counted loss for Christ. Yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss, for that I might, and count them as dung, that I may win Christ." That's a tremendous testimony. The things that are gained to me, those I counted loss for Christ. Also, financial freedom means we will have a clear conscience. And that's so important. 1 Peter 3:16 tells us, having a good conscience, that whereas they speak evil of you as evildoers, that they be ashamed, that falsely accuse your good conversation in Christ. Do we have a clear conscience in our business dealings? My mind goes back and sad commentary about an experience in my life. I was on my way to work, and I needed gas for the vehicle. This was many years ago. It was when $20 would still put quite a significant amount of gas into your gas tank. And I was in a hurry, and I quickly filled up at the station close to where I work and held the pump, and I went stop at $20, and I stopped it, and it said $20.01. And I rushed in to pay for the gas, and I handed a $20 bill across the counter, and the young girl there, she smiled at me and she said, "$20.01, please." And I showed my dismay, I think. Yes, I know I did. Shouldn't have. And I reached in my pocket and pulled out another $20 bill. And so then she counted 10, 15, 17, 19, 1925, 1950, 1975, 1985, 1995, there were still pennies then, 96, 97, 98, 99. And I turned and left with my handful of change and went to work. I wasn't more than sitting at my desk, and my conscience took over as to what type of a testimony was that. Glenn, you purchased $20.01 worth of gas. Why do you think you should have only paid $20 for it, even though that's usually what happens? Tried to work. 5 minutes later, I pulled out the phone book, and I found the station and the address for the station, and I called up, and I said, you might remember me. I was in there to buy $20 worth of gas just a few minutes ago. Yeah, I remember. And I said, I am sorry. I ask for your forgiveness. My approach was terribly wrong. I was upset with you for charging me $20.01 when I purchased $20.01 when I thought I should get that gas for $20. And she said, that's okay. Anyway, I felt better. Those situations are going to come in our lives, and we don't want our reputation to be tarred or tarnished or marred. So we need to follow the example of Zacchaeus. When he met Jesus, what did he do? He genuinely repented. He made complete restitution, and he thereby enjoyed, and you and I can enjoy, the approval of God on our lives. Further, financial bondage means we're going to avoid those sales pitches that come our way. And one of the most successful door-to-door salesman approach to make a sale was when the person opened the door, he would say, "Sir or madam, let me show you a little item that your neighbor said you couldn't afford." Avoid the sales pressures. Don't make major decisions the same day. "But the price is going up tomorrow, right? Or this is the last one that's left." Watch the advertising. Watch the false claims. Build resistance to this. Buying a car, it just bothers me. It's the oldest gimmick in the book, that you talk to the salesman, you are writing up a deal for a car, and you come to the point of the price, and he says he needs to go and he needs to talk to the sales manager for a lower price. And we've all experienced it. See whether I can get a lower price. And how often do you think that salesman actually goes and talks to somebody? Doesn't happen. They leave you sitting there, that you're second guessing yourself, or want you to come to this place to think you have a good deal. Be careful of these things. Watch these pressures. And here are some safeguards to avoid in overspending and yielding to those sales pitches. Relate the money to the time worked to earn it. Compare the cost with other things that could be purchased, and check a consumer's guide. There are guides out there that speak to that washing machine that you need. Check it out. How has the model you're looking at performed? What are the pros and cons about it? Put your earnings in account. Don't be carrying a lot of loose cash or credit card too readily available. And look at the price before you look at the product. Too many times we look at the product and then we look at the price when we're already sold. And really make sure you know the full cost and research the hidden costs. Also in our grocery shopping and other shopping, determine the unit price when you're buying quantity. Is it really a good price unit-wise? When we buy a new appliance, we have them until now, until he retired, we would go to our faithful appliance men who repaired our appliances, and we would say, Mr. Siegler, is this a good model of oven to buy? Should we be buying this one? And he would readily tell us what's wrong or what's right with that. And further, make sure husbands, make sure wives, that you check with each other before making a major purchase. Answer these following questions before you purchase something. Do I really need it? Am I buying more quality than I need? Does it do what it claims to do? Does the company stand behind it? Will it soon be outdated? Does my use justify the purchase? Financial planning, it is important. Planning and how we manage what God has entrusted to us as stewards. Let's commit our ways and our works unto the Lord, and then our thoughts shall be established. And God will give us clear direction. He gave Noah clear direction when it came to building the ark. It was very precise how that ark was to be built. God gave very clear, precise, and exact measurements for Moses in the building of the tabernacle and how tabernacle worship should be conducted. No, we can't go to the Bible to get an answer whether we should buy a 2010 car or a 2015 car. No, we don't. But we have the principles in God's Word to guide us and to direct us. I'd like to move on now and look at retirement, which comes sooner rather than later. And when we think of retirement, when we're no longer able to work, how much are we going to need? Well, none of us know that. But in my experience in dealing with people, many individuals have much more than they need or ever will use as expenses go down during retirement. It's safe to say I think retirement is probably going to take 30 to 50% of our pre-retirement income. There's a lot of costs we will no longer have when we're not working. And we have concerns about the future. We think of nursing home costs, which are very expensive. Or is our family going to look after us? And the ideal, of course, would be to run out of money the day we die, but none of us can plan to that extent, to that detail. And none of us, or we don't want to be like the family who gathered to hear the reading of a last will, and it said, being of sound mind, I spent it all. So what is enough? Will it remain enough? That's very difficult to know. All I can suggest to you is to be faithful with God has entrusted to you. Be a good steward of what God has given to your care. And there's a place for retirement savings plans. There's a place for tax-free savings plans, I believe, to help us out in our retirement years. We want to live responsibly, and we know that God will undertake. And there are many, or there are some, who have a doctrine of non-accumulation out there that we should not be setting aside funds for retirement. But do we want to become a burden to our children or to society? Yes, okay, there's welfare out there, but is that right? And further, I've seen too many situations, and this really troubles me, that before a mother or a father goes into a nursing home, that the money will all be given to the children or most of it, so there's no money left. They enter the nursing home, and then the government needs you and I and our taxes are paying for those people to be in a nursing home. That, to me, is a strong word maybe, but I believe that that is fraudulent or very close to it. I think we can determine, while we're in our retiring years, what we need and how much we can give, how much we help others, how much we assist our children during that time. We come then to wills and powers of attorney. Spiritually, we know that it's very important that we're ready to die. All of us know that. But from a stewardship perspective, it's also very important that we are ready to die. We know it's appointed unto man once to die. And I find it hard to believe, but statistically, 80% of individuals do not have a will. 80% of individuals do not have a will. That follows through into our audience here tonight. There's a significant number of you that have not made a will or do not have an up-to-date will. Biggest enemy to making a will is that of procrastination. I don't get around to doing it, or that it will cost too much to make a will. And it does cost to have a lawyer draw up a will, probably around $200. And somehow we get this idea, I hope not, but somehow we get this idea, or people do, that if I make my will, it's going to speed up my death. It means that my death is just around the corner if I make a will. And that's not the case, because our lives are in God's hands. Let's remember that when we leave it all behind. It's all left here. And it never ceases to amaze me how we spend so many of our working hours and working years accumulating possessions and so little time planning on how to distribute what we have left over at the time we leave, and what we leave behind. And we make some excuses that we really don't know what and how we want to distribute our assets, or that our assets may be very minimal. I get asked the question, how old should I be when I make my first will? Well, it really doesn't determine on age, but it is determined as to when you are working, when you have some assets, then you should make a will. And when your situation changes and you get married, you definitely need to make a new will. And a will is simply your written instructions. It's the orderly, it's the legal way of declaring your wishes in writing, making a final disposition of what God has entrusted to you that you were a steward and trustee of. Wills are really not that complicated. They don't need to be, and there is a number of factors that we want to consider. First of all, ask you a question. Do you know, if you are one of the planning type of people, and I hope you are, and you have a will, do you know where the original will is? And your mind can go immediately to your safety deposit box or to safe box or something like that. But I have a hunch that if you were to look at it, when you get to the last page, it would have copy written on it, and it would not be signed. It would not be the original will. So where is the original? 99% of the time, your original will is with the lawyer. And the reason that the lawyer keeps that will, and there's no lawyers here, is they're looking for future business. They'll tell you it's for safekeeping, and it is, but it's also for future business that they hope to get at the time that you die. So you need to know where the original will is. One of the first things you have to consider when you make a will is executors. And that's a fancy word. It's simply those that become the stewards, the trustees. It's those that you appoint to administer your affairs and to distribute your estate. If you die intestate, and that means if you die without a will, your family is in a quandary. Because who has the right to become the steward and the trustee of your affairs to dispose your assets? So someone has to go to the courts and apply to do that. And maybe not all of the children are going to agree who that should be. And the courts may ask that you have to post a bond to make sure that you're faithful in your responsibility. So don't put your family, if you don't love your family, yeah, die without a will. Please make sure that you make a will. And then you need to consider, as I said, who is going to be the executor. And we often think of the role of an executor of a will as being a most honorable position, and it's something that everybody would just be honored to do. But by all means, make sure you ask the person who you put on your will for executor ahead of time whether they're willing to serve in that capacity. It takes time. It takes effort to be executor of a will. If everything goes smoothly and well, it's not that bad, but there's always some wrinkles along the way that come along. So ask also then, don't make your executors become detectives. In other words, tell them where your original will is and share with them your financial situation. Share with them your net worth that they know in what banks or what investment vehicles your assets are. I shake my head when I see these ads in the paper when people are looking for assets. Or when you have to run to every bank in town and ask if so-and-so had an account here. That should not have to be the role of an executor, but you should have clear records of this for your executors. Your beneficiaries then. In a will, you have beneficiaries. And that is who is going to receive the assets when you pass away. To whom are they going to be transferred? Who is going to assume the responsibility of becoming steward and trustee of the assets that God had entrusted to you? When the first of the two of you in a husband-wife relationship pass away, it's fairly easy and it's fairly obvious, and that it should be 100% to your spouse. Your will should read that 100% goes to your spouse. But then when the second of the two of you pass away, then other beneficiaries need to enter into the picture, which usually include children and grandchildren. And make sure your will is making those bequests, those amounts, by percentages, not by dollar value, because you don't know what the dollar value of your estate's going to be when you pass away. And charities also could be listed, should be listed in as receivable bequests. I have a concern, however, unless you don't have children necessarily, that charities receive all of a sudden a huge windfall. Many charities, or some charities I have noticed, when they receive a huge windfall at one point from an estate, they make some decisions for that charity that are no longer sustainable in the years down the road because the money is not there. You're much better to give most of your giving while you are living. Make sure your assets are joint as a husband and wife. You might be surprised. To my shame, I acted a number of years ago as an executor for a husband and wife, and he passed away, and I thought this is going to be quite easy. There's a farm. Lo and behold, I hadn't asked the question. He had never put that farm in joint ownership. Legally, it was her farm. That's what the law would say. But on title and with the registry office, it was only in his name. And that was a cost of thousands of dollars just in order to put that farm in her name. Let's make sure the amount that we're passing on to our children is not an amount that's going to drastically change their lifestyle. And I'm not going to stand here and put a dollar value on that, but you know your family, you know your children, and you know how you should set things up. one of the hardest decisions in making a will, but yet so most very important, is for young families, parents with children that are minors. Who is going to become guardian should both husband and wife be taken in a situation at the same time? That's a very, very difficult situation to think through. Who has the values? Who has the beliefs? Who has the energy? Who has the time? Who is going to raise my children most like I would like to have seen them raised if I were still here? And that is important. And make sure you ask those individuals again, just like you ask executors, are you willing to become a guardian for my children should we both be taken in a common disaster such as a car accident? Keep your will up to date. Circumstances change, so should your will. And by all means, if you're rewriting your will, which you should if your circumstances change, make sure you destroy the old one. Don't have family situations turn up where there's all of a sudden two wills and there's been changes made in them, obviously, because there was a new will made. Destroy that old will. Don't leave it lying around. Fortunately, and rightly so, there are no inheritance taxes when money passes from one generation to the next, and there shouldn't be. That money that your parents had was after-tax money. They'd paid the tax on that. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that the government is very much looking for funds. So they don't call it inheritance tax, but what the government will do is say before financial institutions, before registry offices can deal with transfer of assets, transfer of ownership of property, a will has to be probated. That's a big word, and it simply means the will is taken to the courts and they put a stamp on it that this is the last will. And that they can then deal with those people who are listed as the executors. That way, if a newer will shows up with different executors or different distribution, that will that the executors had brought, which was purported to be the last will, is the one that's acted upon. It's supposed to protect that you're not giving the assets to the wrong individuals. For example, I'm Johnny Smith, and I have one brother and one sister, and the will said it's equally divided to all three of us, and then I have a fallout with my dad. He changes his will, and it goes to the two. I show up at the bank with the original will, the first will, and they give it three ways. Then all of a sudden, the newer will, the bank would have to pay out the difference. So that's why they will ask for probating of a will. Now that makes reasonable sense, but what does not make sense is the amount of money and fee that is charged to probate a will. It's $5 per thousand value of the estate for the first $50,000, and after that it jumps to $15 per thousand. So people have started to do all kinds of creative things to try and avoid probating a will, friends. Some of them are a good idea, some of them are not. I suggest to you that if you have extra funds that you know you are going to be giving to your children, maybe that you would write promissory notes to them and write them at 0% on demand for given at death. In other words, pre-give some of your inheritance to your children while they're younger, while they need it. That will not be an asset of the estate to be probated, because that was a promissory note that could be called back if I needed the funds for retirement, the home or something like that. But if I die, it's forgiven. So in other words, it's no longer part of the estate. What people try to do is they'll get one of the children to be joint on the asset with the parent. And that can be okay. But I could tell you horror stories where that was never the intent of that parent with joint and last survivorship, that when they passed away, that this was the sibling's money only. It then becomes the choice of that sibling, that child. Are they going to honor the will, or is this now my money? There's some Christmas dinners that are not happening anymore because of people do some very, very strange things over a few dollars. Please set your situation up in a way that there is no fights, that there is nothing like this after your passing away. Before you pass away, now already, all of you should have a power of attorney in place. Power of attorney is simply a document that indicates, should I become incapacitated? In other words, if I have a stroke or whatever, so-and-so can look after my affairs. Husbands should designate their wives and each other, and perhaps a secondary one. There's two kinds of power of attorney. One's for property, which means for finances and for properties. The second one is for personal care. And that personal care power of attorney is end-of-life decisions or decisions about your medical care. Should you have a stroke, who decides if you're on life support? When is the plug pulled? One child says, don't pull the plug, and the other one says, pull the plug. What do the doctors do? That's why they insist when you enter a nursing home that there's a power of attorney for personal care, that somebody is designated to make those decisions. Talk to your family about that, about life support and things of that nature. Set up, make sure you have power of attorney in place for your affairs. We never know what is ahead for us. Also, this may sound morbid to some of you, but as pastors, we love it. Write out your funeral directions, instructions. Make known what you would like as a fitting service. The pallbearers, who you would like to share in the service. What the message should be. What the text should be for the message. I told you this sounds morbid, but do it. It's appreciated by the family. Families sometimes don't make the best decisions, especially when it's a sudden death, and all of a sudden they're overwhelmed with all these decisions that have to be made. Also, nothing wrong with going in and pre-planning your funeral at the funeral home and picking out your casket, if I may say that. Take that stress away from your family members. Prepay your funeral. When it's looked after, inflation won't affect it. Just some tidbits that I think are part of good stewardship. That brings to a close what I wanted to share this evening, but I had indicated in the email that went out that there was to be interaction, there was to be time for questions and for discussion, and sad to say, because of my long-windedness, that has not happened. But I would give opportunity just now, whether there's been anything that's been said this weekend that's raised any questions in your mind that you would like clarification on or that you would like to comment on. Question Larry is asking about the ads you see for your self-kit homemade wills, whether those are legitimate wills. I want to be careful how I answer that question. They probably are. There's a case in Saskatchewan, and I could take you to a museum there where there's a red tractor fender in the museum that is the last will and testament of a farmer that was out in the fields. He didn't have a will. He rolled the tractor, and he died before anyone came to help him, but he had a screwdriver with him, and he scratched on that fender of the tractor his will, and it stood up in court. The problem I see with these self-kits is that they might not take into situation all of your specific circumstances, that I think it's worth the $200 to get a lawyer to do it. But they're better than no will. I'll say that. Anyone else? God bless you richly. I'm excited for the future because God is in control. Do I know what the future holds? No, nor do you. But I do have the assurance that God will direct us and God will guide us each step of the way. Remember Proverbs 3, verse 5 and 6, that we trust in the Lord with all our heart, that we do not lean on our own understanding, but that in all our ways acknowledge Him, and I assure you, He will direct our paths. God bless you, and I'll turn it back to Larry.